Hosted by Savi Luis Burgos, this is Decolonial Subjects, where conversations amongst Boricuas are a means of decolonization. Decolonial Subjects is a co-production of Gozamos.com and La Respuesta magazine.
Welcome to this episode of Decolonial Subjects. I am your host, Xavier Luis Burgos. I have a very special guest today, you know, from back in the day. All my guests I know from back in the day. That's how I recruit people. I have Dorian Ortega, and we're going to speak today about Puerto Ricans, Latinos, and mental health. She's a clinical psychologist. She actually just graduated last year from the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. She specializes in Latino mental health. She's also a native of Humboldt Park. Both her paternal and maternal grandparents migrated to Chicago in the 1960s from Puerto Rico. And she has worked in many initiatives around community health research in different projects such as asthma in the Puerto Rican community in Humboldt Park, Chicago. Thank you, and welcome today, Dorian.
Thank you.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Again, in Siberia, so this is a really cold day, right? Always talk about the weather.
Yeah.
It's really cold, but you got here on time, actually early, you know what I'm saying? Puerto Ricans do come early, y'all, letting you know.
Happens.
That's a stereotype. But so we're going to talk about mental health today, right? This is the field that you specialize in. What exactly is a clinical psychologist? What does she or he do? What do you do?
So I'm going to kind of break down what I do. So my role is actually a clinical, I'm a behavioral health clinician. And so I'm a master's level clinical counselor. And so a clinical counselor basically provides services to people who have problems or issues with behavior, with mood. And so it's a little different from clinical, like psychologists and psychiatrists. Although like we do really similar work, clinical psychologists would be like a PhD level, right? And they have more experience in the field, and they also have a higher level of like authority over like what kind of measures that they can use, like assessments. And so as a master's level clinician, there's certain tests that I can administer and there's certain ones that I can't. So, I think that's probably the major difference other than, the doctorate level, they obviously have more experience, and are able to teach at a university level. And so my role, my experience, is to provide, services depending on what we see. So, I see a lot of children. I see a lot of families, mostly for behavioral issues, mostly for depression, mostly for anxiety. Those are the most common, issues that I see in the clinic that I work in.
Okay. Cool. So what brought you to the field?
What brought me to the field, honestly, was, my interest. I've always had an interest, I think, in relationships and with interactions. I've always kind of been interested in how people process things and how they go about, you know, where's their behavior come from. And so that I think that with the experience in my personal experience with, a family history of substance abuse, of depression, of anxiety, it kind of lured me into this field and wanting to know more and wanting to know how to deal with things like that. And why do those things happen? Why do people have to react that way? Why do people get depressed, and what can you do about it? And so, my interest in the field was to be a practitioner. So it was to work in the field and to work with people and understand where they're coming from and help them to change so that they can feel better or be able to function.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that? I mean, because, you know, in our community, right, and you mentioned this before, but if you can reiterate, you know, Puerto Ricans don't really go to therapy, there's a stigma around going to therapy or going to a counselor. I mean, So how are you able to like work with people with the stigma attached to it? I mean, what obstacles have you faced?
Yeah, I working with that, I think that especially with the Latino community, there is a stigma. I think there's a stigma overall for mental health. I think it has a lot to do with explaining the process, right? Normalizing what they're going through. I think that's probably one of the most important, because a lot of people think that coming into therapy, they're crazy, right? I lost control and I have no control and I'm not going to be respected as a family member or as a, you know, a person in my community because I need help now. And so I think that's probably one of the biggest issues, is trying to bring back that control over people's lives and trying to normalize that what they're going through is what other people have gone through. You know, they're not the first, they're not the last. And so, I think that's been probably one of the biggest and most important things, to explain the process and to really be culturally aware where they're coming from, to know that, to try to really understand that person and where they're coming from, their family, their history, their culture, and really trying to incorporate that in the session. You really want to know what it is that worked for them and why is it that it stopped working, and let's talk about that. I think one of the biggest issues too is some people aren't ready to deal with the issues that they have. It's not easy to rehash old wounds, and that's the process of therapy, is opening up those wounds and really working through them. And a lot of times people aren't ready for that, and people really want to move on, but fortunately sometimes, you know, when you don't deal with things, they catch up to you, right? And so we see that a lot with adults, you know, we see that a lot with adults who have dealt with things their whole lives, and now they're seeing, like, you know, health consequences.
Physical health?
Yeah, physical health consequences, stress-related consequences. And it has to do with, you know, it's accumulation. You know, stress is so powerful, and it can overcome. It can impact your health. You have cancers, you have diabetes, you have, like, all of these other things that can impact you. It can be accumulation of things that you just haven't dealt with, or, you know, I've been pushing aside, and now you're paying the consequences later in life.
And how do you make it? You mentioned culturally relevant, right?
Yeah.
How do you, because some folks might say, like, well, we're all human beings, right? And we all face, you're laughing, right? We all face like different, you know, or similar issues, right? Like relationships and families, right? All our families are crazy, right? So why is it important to make therapy culturally relevant, especially when you're encountering clients or patients or Boricua and Latino?
Yeah. I think it's really important because, first of all, because the profession itself is based on a white population.
Okay.
So, the theories, the practices, everything is based on white Europeans. So we have to meet people where they're at. We have to, learn their history. We have to know their culture. We have to know what's going on in terms of their country of origin, political relevance to the U.S. We have to know those things, because that's going to affect this person in a different way than it would a white person that grew up in America. And so a lot of these theories are old, you know, and a lot of research now is trying to create new theories of multicultural counseling theory, where we're incorporating all of the cultural things that impact us. I mean, it wasn't taken into consideration a long time ago when psychology was, you know, emerging. So, these things are important. And so for a program that I went through to understand the Latino mental health is to understand their history, is to understand, you know, everything, you know, their native culture, the food, their practices, and, you know, how far back those practices go.
Like what? Give me some examples.
So, so let's say for example, other religion. I think religion is probably the biggest. So not everybody practices religion in the same way, right? Most Latinos, most Puerto Ricans are like Christian or Catholic faith. But they practice in different ways, right? So you have, and you also have branches of that religion. And when you see, for example, when you see for Mexican population or for Central American population, you see curanderos. Mm-hmm. And so in Puerto Rican population, you'll see, I can't think of...
Like santeros, right?
Right, santeros, okay. Right? Mm-hmm. And so which is like similar to like bringing those Catholic or those Christianity beliefs and really using culture, like African culture or native culture, and blending them together to provide like... healing yeah. services to mm-hmm. people. So it's really understanding that culture, right? And really respecting it, right? And believing okay. people that if they went to a santero and this is what they were going through, and they went to a santero and they couldn't, you know, or whatever the case may be, they went and they tried to get a cure for something, and for me on my end, I have to understand that's where their culture is. Mm-hmm. That they respect somebody that is respected mm-hmm. in their community, mm-hmm. right? I think that's another really big point, is that people aren't going to come to you when they can go to somebody that they know, mm-hmm. right? Why would I share my business with a stranger? Mm-hmm. I don't know you. You know, that's another value that Latinos have, is the keeping everything within the family, mm-hmm. right? We don't want to put our business out mm-hmm. like that. And so mm-hmm. why would I go and tell a stranger? Mm-hmm. And so it's really understanding that and trying to build respect and trying to build a relationship with that person mm-hmm. and trying to build that trust, mm-hmm. you know, and get to know them. And that's really what you'll be doing in the beginning of therapy, is really getting to know that person, trying to build trust with them, trying to understand where they're coming from, what are their practices, what are things that they believe in, what do they value? Because it may be different, right? Not every person that you see that grew up in the U.S. or was born here might have the same beliefs that maybe like a traditional, I don't know, like traditional values that would be very American. Mm-hmm. They carry values from their parents. They carry values from their culture. And then some people don't. Some mm-hmm. people don't disregard their culture. So it's like mm-hmm. you have to really work with what you have. Mm-hmm. And I think just knowing the history is so important. Knowing the other venues, right? Santeria and religion and knowing all these other venues, knowing that people take advantage of those venues is going to be really important for trying to get to know that person and trying to see where you can fit in and what you can do for them.
And how do you balance that? I read an article last night. And I was so scared because I had to light a candle. So me, I'm doing little Santeria and stuff because yeah. I was like, oh my God, reading this stuff scares me. It was a woman who had three children, and she was encountering, and she believed that she was seeing demons, right? And that her children were possessed. And I got a lot of news. I mean, Fox News, I mean, that's not a credible channel, but Fox News covered it, and yeah. The Indianapolis Star also covered it. And you know, she was going to different santeros and different churches to try to cleanse the home, right, and do all these things. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, the Department of Children's Services took the children away because they believed that she was inflicting this trauma upon her children by having them believe that there were demons in the house, right? Mm-hmm. And the story went on, right, to actually, like, one of the nurses actually saw, like, a demon, so it was like they actually believed it. It was interesting story. Yeah. But you, as a therapist, right, as a counselor, how do you balance between respecting, like, people's religious beliefs and culture beliefs and also measuring how much is actually it could be harming, like, a family or children in this case? How do you do that?
Yeah, it can be, I mean, it can be tricky, right, because you need to understand the situation, right, and you have mm-hmm. to take in consideration that what she's seeing, she really believes that, mm-hmm. right? Even if for somebody that, so when we do an assessment, right? We do an assessment and we want to see if you're hearing things and you're seeing things that may or may not be there or that other people aren't seeing. If you're seeing hallucinations, you're seeing illusions or whatever the case may be. Now there can be a cultural relevance to that, mm-hmm. right? So many people see their dead relatives, mm-hmm. right? And that's a cultural norm mm-hmm. in their culture, is to see people that really just passed away, mm-hmm. hear their voices, mm-hmm. see things around, and that's part of their grieving process.
Mm-hmm.
We have to respect that and not say that they're psychotic, mm-hmm. right?
So it's not saying you believe it or don't believe it, it's respecting
that. Right, it's okay. respecting that that's part of their cultural norm, mm-hmm. right? And even if it is somebody that is to the point where they see a demon or they believe that they're possessed, you have to go with it. Mm-hmm. Because if you go against it, mm-hmm. you may cause more harm, right? Really? So somebody who is diagnosed with like schizophrenia and does see hallucinations and believes that the government is after them, mm-hmm. You need to go with it. Mm-hmm. You need to meet them where they're at, and you need to figure out, okay, if I need to get more information about your past, try to decipher what could be real and what can be an illusion, mm-hmm. and get to know that person. Okay, hear their story out. What's going on in their past? What happened to that person growing up? What is the traumas that they're living in their life, so that I can get a better idea of, okay, these are where these ideas are coming from, and this is how we can understand you a little bit better. But you don't want to go against it. You don't.
And how do you do that? How do you move? So what's the next step? Because psychologists love like steps and like models, right?
Yeah.
I have a degree in sociology, so I always make fun of psychologists. But and so what's the next step from that? So you're meeting people where they're at, mm-hmm. you make them feel comfortable with you, because you mentioned a lot of folks don't want to say their business, right? Mm-hmm. Outside of their family. Yeah. And so after you build that rapport with the patient, then what do you do to like work through that trauma? I mean, mm-hmm. like, I guess the basic question is, can people be cured of these things?
There is not a cure okay. for mental illnesses. Okay. There isn't some sort of cure. So I think the idea for at least for people who want to be in therapy temporarily, mm-hmm. is to at least at minimum get back to functioning. Mm-hmm. If you have a problem going to work, if you have a problem getting along with somebody, if you have a problem not being able to get up in the morning, then we need to get you back there.
Okay.
And so we need to take the steps that are necessary to get you back to functioning, mm-hmm. at minimum. Okay. Whether or not you're functioning as a chronic depressive person, mm-hmm. okay, we can function and at least get you out of bed, at least get you to work and brush your teeth every day. Okay. And so those are the things that we first are going to try, right? Mm-hmm. If we're working on like what Bronfenbrenner's like theory of, starting from the bottom, like making sure that you're safe, right? Mm-hmm. Making sure that you're being fed, making sure that you're getting your needs met. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're going to start. We're going to start with making sure that you're getting your needs met, you're safe, and that you're getting back to functioning. Mm-hmm. That's where we want to start. If it's at that level, mm-hmm. right? So we want to make sure that we'll take it. And that takes time. Mm-hmm. It's not...
How long?
It depends, okay. right? It takes time to get to know somebody, yeah. right? From
one week sessions, right?
It can be weekly sessions. It could be, a year. It can be getting to know somebody, building that rapport can take time. Mm-hmm. And then the work and the juice of it or the meat of it will depend. Right. It depends on your relationship with that person. Depends on people. It depends on the quality of the therapist. Right. Mm-hmm. And it also depends if that person is committed, mm-hmm. and motivated to make changes or ready to make changes.
And how do you do that? So and I can see, I guess some of our listeners would be like, wow, like going through a long, tumultuous and painful process. It's like, I don't got time for that. Yeah. I got work. I got kids.
Yeah.
I'm on food stamps, right? Some of our listeners might be on food stamps, mm-hmm. right? We know Puerto Ricans are one of the poorest groups in this country, right?
Yeah.
And so how do you do that when someone's struggling with so many stuff and all they have with you is conversation?
Yeah, an hour, right?
An hour, yeah.
Maybe, an hour maybe. And so it depends, right? It depends mm-hmm. on their situation, right? And that's why at minimal, depending on what kind of theory you work off of and what kind of therapist you are, with somebody who is like struggling and who has all of these other barriers, right? Your job can be to hear them out, right? To be a source of support. Or you're always going to be a source of support. You're always going to be able to provide some positive regards for them. You want to make sure that you're that person that is there to hear them out, right? That could be the work. Right. That could be the work right there. That could be the outlet that person might need, is to vent. Mm-hmm. Right. And to talk it out. And you could be the therapist that you want to see goals, right? A lot of insurance companies want to see numbers, right? If you want to be, if you want to continue to be funded, mm-hmm. they want to see how are these people doing, right?
Insurance companies do that?
Yes, I didn't know that. Of course. So some insurance companies give you, like the government, for example, Medicaid, they give you 10 sessions. Right. For like a for if a kid has all kids. Right. Or that's Medicaid. Right. Mm-hmm. You get like 10 sessions
free.
Yeah.
Without
co-payment. Right.
OK.
So you get 10 free sessions. And if the person is in need of more care, then you have to like fill out forms to reauthorize them for more and more and more.
OK. So they can continually go to
right. You can, depending on the need, right? Okay. And you have to, I have to judge whether you need it or not, mm-hmm. right? It comes down to where that person is at, mm-hmm. So it depends. I mean, it depends on the person, right? And something that I've considered for the people who cannot come in, right? The people who really struggle to find time to even make it to even doctor's appointments, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, so a lot of the work will be hearing them out, right? It will be being a source of support and helping them to self-manage. Okay. What they're going through, mm-hmm. get them to functioning and have them practice things outside of therapy. Mm-hmm. The majority of the work is going to be outside of therapy anyways. Mm-hmm. That's why it's dependent a lot on the client to mm-hmm. see what are they willing to do mm-hmm. and practice outside of therapy. And so I think a lot of it will be like self-management. A lot of it will be like self-care, teaching those kind of skills. So that they can at least function, mm-hmm. right? With all these barriers that they have, they mm-hmm. can at least get by. Mm-hmm. And if that's where we can be, if that's what it takes, you know, if that's at least the minimal goal that we can accomplish, then that's what we're gonna work off of.
And so, what is self care? Because I hear self care a lot, especially in activist groups, right? Like, okay. you know, that they're talking about, you know, because in activism, and that this is like connected to our other podcast that we had and that you should listen to, audience. You know, when you're so busy and so engaged and you're giving so much and to change the world and change your community, yeah. like it becomes overwhelming. And so you need a space of self-care. So I've heard that word a lot in that context, but yeah. I've also heard it in other contexts too. So what is self-care? What would you say?
Self-care and yeah, we've talked about this before, right? self-care is taking care of yourself. I mean, really is really self-explanatory. Mm-hmm. It's really finding time to kind of do something that you enjoy, right? Okay. Do something that's less, that's stress-free, if it can be at least not a lot of stress, has to do with doing this, you know, activity. And so we've talked about this before, right? For a therapist or for somebody who works with stressful populations or work in stressful situations or do community work, because that is and can be very stressful and time consuming. Self-care can be something very simple. You know, it can be a vacation, right? Mm-hmm. Some people don't got money or time for that, right? It can be as little as spending 5 minutes alone, quiet, meditating, praying, you know, taking a bubble bath, you know, doing a manicure, getting a pedicure, you know, just taking some time to breathe and relax and kind of be with yourself. And that's, I mean, that's really what it can be. Whether people feel comfortable or find the time for that, that's, I think it can be so simple as 3 minutes a day or 5 minutes a day of just relax, of just kind of be alone and meditate, take some deep breaths, and do something small that you enjoy. It doesn't have to take a lot of time.
And every day,
it could be a little bit every day. Okay. It can be a little bit every day. Some people struggle with this, mm-hmm. right? Some people struggle with this. It's so funny
really?
That
taking 5 minutes
that
out of
we
a day?
Yes, because 5 minutes can be a long time mm-hmm. when you think about it. Yeah. you yeah. count the numbers. I mean, it's like sitting for by yourself, breathing. Like that sounds like a long time, you know. And I suggested this to somebody that I know recently, who is constantly on her phone, constantly on the go, constantly mm-hmm. stressing, constantly just she's like on the go, on the go, on the go. Like she can't sit still. And so, you know, I suggested to her, like, you know, you need to really take 3 minutes, just 3 minutes, just sit in silence without the phone, just chill, like relax for five, you know, 3 minutes. If you can't do five, do three, two and a half, something, you know? And it was a real struggle for her. Wow. She could not sit alone without doing something for 3 minutes, 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're on the go society, right? Mm-hmm. We're in Chicago. We're in a, you know, in this urban kind of community where everything's on the go. Everything's on the go. We're getting texts. We're getting Facebook messages. We're getting a Twitter. We're getting this and that and this and that.
Sorry, he's hitting you up for articles for a lot of press stuff, right?
You know, so it's like always on the go. There's always something to see. There's always something to do. And self-care can be as quick as, like, I'm not going to check an email for 3 minutes. I'm just going to chill. I'm just going to relax. Or setting boundaries for yourself, right? Mm-hmm. I know in school, you know, this one girl suggested, like, after a certain time at night, I don't check my emails. I don't do any more reading. I cut it out, mm-hmm. right? So setting boundaries for yourself is going to be important, too. You know, you can be a yes person all the time, but, you know, knowing when to say no, especially I think in community work, is going to be a little bit more tricky, right? If you're always the go-to person, or if it's always the same people doing the same work over and over and over, that gets kind of tricky. But being able to balance out somehow is going to be so important. At minimum, trying to balance the work and play is going to be really important for your self-care and your mental health in general. Because where you start to have problems is when you're overworked, you're overwhelmed, and you can't get your stuff together, right? You can't work, you can't concentrate, you're forgetting things, and that's where you start to have problems.
And so for Puerto Ricans and Latinos, right? I mean, because you mentioned culture, you mentioned self-care, you mentioned, like, the, you know, the context we're in Chicago. I mean, a lot of Boricuas, most Boricuas are in urban areas, right, on the island and in the U.S.
Yeah.
And major urban areas, right, is New York, Cleveland, you know, giving shout-outs to these places, right, Detroit, Orlando. And so I guess what's the relationship between racism, identity, and mental health, right? Because I've also heard, so not only we have to all these struggles of poverty and living in these urban areas, we also are colonial beings, right? This podcast is called Decolonial Subjects, and I've heard Puerto Ricans have one of the highest rates of mental illness in the world. Yeah. And so what do you think about that as someone who's in this field, and how do you work towards that or with that?
Racism, it's a constant reminder, mm-hmm. right? You're constantly reminded that you're different from everybody else. Mm-hmm. And that does impact you. That does is going to make you, you know, feel belittled. It's going to make you feel inferior, mm-hmm. and, you know, whatever I do is not good enough, basically. You know, I'm never going to really get to the American dream. I'm never really going to reach that. It's unrealistic to me. What is the point? You know, and people lose motivation. People really start to lose it, you know, with that. And so, yeah, I definitely think that's a huge issue. And definitely impacts your mental health. If you feel that you can't never get to a place that's promised, right? You can never get to the place, the illusion that other people can. So no, for sure. I think that's definitely an issue. I was going to say something, but I forgot.
There's no forgetting here.
Sorry. No, I'm just thinking of say the status of immigration. Like, a lot of my clients, you know, I don't see a lot of Puerto Rican clients. Most of my clients are Mexican or Central American. But the biggest issue is that's out of their control is immigration. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're undocumented. You know, and that's a huge barrier. Some are unable to work. Some are barely making it by, but, mm-hmm. What I think and I think what's really understudied or under it's not talked about a lot is the resiliency of the people that live here and face racism, constant racism, right? Mm-hmm. Chronic racism. Mm-hmm. But it's the resiliency. Like, mm-hmm. people get by. People can survive. Mm-hmm. People get through it. People overcome. You know, some way, somehow, through support, through their family, right? People can get by. You know, it's an unfortunate thing that happens, but so many unfortunate things happen, right? We can't wait for the government to finally recognize all of these things. People take action, right? You have people who are taking action for immigration reform. You have people taking action and talking about, you know, whiteness and how and racism and things like that, and talking about it in schools and talking about it in social media and really bringing the issues to light. And I think social media is really blossomed in that way and has been an outlet for people to really get to see that information before it's probably in the books and people just talk about it in the universities and things like that. But it's a lot more open and it's a lot more, you know, so people know a lot more about it and they're able to deal with it and talk about it and process it in their own ways. So so I think that, yes, of course, it's an issue and it's going to impact us. But I think there's also a lot of resiliency and room to grow and room to kind of make your own way through all of this crap that you have to kind of move out of the way or kind of take with you in terms of baggage and just kind of carry through and carry on to do what you need to do in life. So
why don't you see a lot of Puerto Ricans? Why aren't Puerto Ricans going to therapy?
I don't know. I think a lot has to do with, you know, from personal reasons, from what I've hear, you know, not non-research related. Like when I hear other people just, you know, just talking about it, it's a prideful, you know, it's the idea that that I can take care of things myself, or I'm not crazy, you know, I got this. And it's a way to know that they didn't totally lose it, that they need to go and seek help and they want to still be respected. So I'm not 100% sure, you know, why people don't come to therapy, why Puerto Ricans don't go to therapy. I mean, but that's something that I think about, some of what I've read. There's a lot of there's a relationship between the colonial status and not attending or at least mental illness. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe not attending, but at least having a mental illness, and not being, you know, not being an independent country and not coming from an independent country, coming from a dependent country. So I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of ideas can come off of that. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe as a Puerto Rican, I want that independence for myself, mm-hmm. to know, mm-hmm. that I have control, mm-hmm. over my life.
Well, that's really profound. Like,
right?
Like the fact that you don't have an independent country, but, you know, you and, like, our people need to feel that we're independent, right, in ourselves. We have self-determination, right?
Yeah. So I don't know, man. I mean, that could be. It could be, but, you know, it definitely is something that we're seeing. You know, we're seeing high, you know, Puerto Ricans have highest substance abuse, highest depression rates, mm-hmm. out of all the other Latinos in the U.S. So we're seeing the consequences. We're seeing the issues, right? We're facing it. We're not seeking help for it, or maybe we're doing it on our own, or maybe we're just getting by.
And so then, so the last thing then is if one of our listeners, right, if our people want to go see a therapist, see a counselor, how would they do that?
Well,
$1 million question, right?
unfortunately, it's not as readily available, right? Last year we had a lot of budget cuts where a lot of community mental health agencies were shut down.
In Chicago, right?
In Chicago. So unfortunately, that's the issue, right? Mm-hmm. Having insurance, right? Mm-hmm. By the end of the year, everybody has to have insurance. So hopefully, you know, you have insurance to see a mental health provider. It is pricey. Mm-hmm. It is expensive, depending on where you go. Mm-hmm. So people usually start off in, you know, checking out the hospitals, checking out their clinics. A lot of community clinics now are providing behavioral health, which is pretty awesome. I think I hope that the government pushes for more holistic care where you can go to one-stop shops and see your doctor, see a social worker, see a therapist,
really?
If you need,
wow.
to, you know, so, okay. So, clinics are kind of heading in that way, I think. Okay. So community clinics, you have community mental health clinics, which are still around. You have, I mean, if we're talking about Humboldt Park, mm-hmm. you have Association House, that provides services, Casa Central, you have Erie, you have St. Mary's that provides psychiatric services, mm-hmm. and counseling. So there are these places. The issue is finding them, right? Is finding these places and seeing if it's affordable. If you have children and you have the medical card, it's a lot easier, right? If you have insurance. But there are places out there. There are places that will not turn you away. I work for Resurrection Behavioral Health. We will not turn you away. We will provide you services and work with you. And so I don't know a lot of places like that, but I know that a lot of places now are not denying that kind of care. So if you can make it, if you can find it, I mean, I will, you know, I'm open to definitely trying to connect anybody that I can. If people like search NAMI, which is National Association for Mental Illness, they have a website. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of look up different agencies or call them and they'll help you find an agency.
So that's NAMI National?
NAMI is, I think, NAMI.com or something like that, okay, NAMI.org.
Okay.
They can help you connect you to services. SAMHSA, which is a substance abuse service.
Mm-hmm. From the federal government, right?
From the government. Yeah. Also has a ton of agencies. Mm-hmm. That you can just put your zip code in and find the place that's convenient for you and in the language that you prefer.
SAMHSA is SAMHSA.
SAMHSA is SAMHSA.
Okay. See, yeah. I can't spell.
It's okay.
I have a college degree, but no spelling.
So there are options out there, right? Okay. And there's also self-help groups, right? People can do groups. People can join online communities where they can find self-help, online chat groups or something like that. That's more, maybe that's easier and free, and people can take advantage of those type of services. You know, people can. I know some church groups run different groups. I know AA has, you know, is a free service. There's also like, what is it? NA, they have another one that is psychologically associated or mental illness. I think Neurotics Anonymous is also a free service.
Okay, that's an interesting
name. So these are, I mean, they're out there and they are, you know, there are those like 12-step kind of programs that are free and can provide that like social support mm-hmm. that some people need. So there's different outlets, mm-hmm. right? There's different outlets. Mental health is getting so creative. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't necessarily have to be somebody that you meet with one-on-one in an office. It can happen in different outlets.
Okay.
And so, which is kind of nice because it can be more convenient for our on-moving and ongoing kind of generation.
Okay, cool. So. Well, thank you. I just feel like I got my own, free 40-minute, therapy session, right?
It's
so it's
good.
Free. This is how I get therapy, y'all. Yeah, I just get my friends to talk about it with me. The last thing, though, is mm-hmm. that you are also on the editorial core mm-hmm. of La Espressa magazine.
Yeah.
And so for our audience and listeners, if you want to read more about mental health and identity and its connection to Puerto Ricans, go to laespressamedia.com and look up Dorian Ortega. And that's one way we are getting this information to our people,
mm-hmm.
right? So
yeah.
Thank you, Dorian.
Thank you.
Have a great day. And thank you for listening to Decolonial Subjects. I am your host, Xavier Luis Burgos. And I had my very special guest, Dorian Ortega, who is a therapist. Thank you.